Welcome to the bookshelf. Tonight we conclude the two-part interview with poet James McCauley. Here's Phyllis Silver.
Welcome to Inland Northwest Voices. I'm Phyllis Silver, and my guest in this second half of a two-part conversation is poet James J. McCauley. Now and again, McCauley is a confessional or autobiographical poet. He will take material from his life and, in the words of Dublin critic John Jordan, write details that have an almost painful intimacy. But in these poems, what appears to be the voice of the poet is a creation, a persona, which represents some carefully selected aspect of the poet's character, some tone, some attitude, but as McCauley explains, it is incapable of being the poet's voice.
When you try to nail down poets, they'll evade the issue because the simple answer is, yes, that's me speaking, you know, and this is what happened and this is how I felt and like that. But there is something that comes into language when you isolate it and shape it into a poem. There's something comes into language that prevents that from being the truth, the absolute truth. And in a funny way, what does come into language is truth. Maybe I should read a poem and see if I can explain. And the very poem I have right here beside me, ready to go, it's called The Boy Who Knew Nine Languages. It's a poem that grew out of my youngest boy Rory's ninth birthday. The Boy Who Knew Nine Languages. When I was one, I was damp and cried in nine languages, but no one came. When I was two, I loved all round things that shone and made a fine noise when I dropped them. My father chewed and spat hot words very loud. When I was three, my feet kept running out from under me. Chairs turned their backs on me when I needed them. Elbows, shins, and eyebrow once spoke bruise and blood. My mother spoke hot words, warm words, cool words. When I was four, I had friends. One I hated, but let him play. One was a secret we talked at night till I fell asleep. I had one best friend, not my brother. He spoke insults. When I was five, I could count to a zillion if I wanted to and read highway signs. I asked questions and sang and got mad. Sometimes I could tell Dad slowly what happened. When I was six, I could read from a book and cut paper and make big letters. Miss Fear taught me, but never listened to anything I told her. When I was seven, I hit a ball high over the cherry tree, a white ball. The blossoms were like skin with little veins. I swam in deep water, scared. I joined a club with code words. We made plans. When I was eight, I learned blackjack and words that make girls blush and giggle. I built model ships and planes till they bored me. My parents divorced. I was sad, but they explained, I'm still sad. Now I'm nine. I draw battles and stars exploding. Sometimes I feel too much to talk about it. I can remember a lot, almost to when I was born. I'm learning violin. Yeah. A lot of that is just fact. You know, it's just, the things that happen in Rory's growing up to be nine. But quite a few, like hitting the ball over the cherry tree, is made up, you know. And supposed to stand for something that really did happen. You know? And I wonder very much if anybody could understand the feeling behind that.
After you write a poem or have been writing a poem, how do you know when it's finished? I mean, how do you know when it works or if it, does it say something to you or it moves you in such a way as this one does?
This was sort of easy. I mean, once, apart from, you know, just tidying it up and keeping it, getting it straightened out. It's a counting poem, so, you know, and nine is a nice mystical number, so that was, took care of that. And, you know, there are forms like sonnets and villanelles that you know when they're finished, when you have the form. Auden says, we never finish our poems, we abandon them. It's like raising kids, you know, almost without noticing it, they're no longer around the house, right? They're not in your consciousness. The poems are no longer, you know, they've gestated into a final form of some kind or another, yeah.
You have a poem that talks about that.
To his host who has asked him to stay longer. It came out of, again, like a lot of the poetry, it came out of going to a party amongst people I hadn't seen for a long time and realizing that we've grown away from each other, that there are familiar things about each other that we kind of cherish, but it's time to go. I found out something, and I think others did too from that party. That, you know, we can't be partying now like we used to in graduate school, you know. Things have changed, you know. Yeah. To his host, who has asked him to stay longer. We've learned in hard ways when we have to go. There's nothing to explain, no one to blame, and so much still to learn of love and sorrow. Our children leave the house before their time, without a quarrel, casual, taking with them nothing to prize, and we may never know what names they'll give their children. Nothing to do but keep the house as neat as a chapel nave, lust after our friends' wives, let the wine flow, dance to old records, whooping like Indian braves. We're lively enough, God knows, till the first one leaves. It's a new kind of politeness we've let grow, going home when the party's in full swing, to save our oldest friends the shame of letting it show, this waking weariness that lays us all so low. Tortured in our own beds by a hopeless fury, we harp on how in youth we were always merry, but can't remember now what made us so. Well, I would hope, again, that just the simple sort of social implications of that were penetrated by something besides. Something that if I could explain, I wouldn't have to write the poem, right? A kind of mystery about that language, even. You know, it came out rhyming. You know, I wrote a different kind of poem initially, and then found that there were a number of places where rhyme seemed to be hinted, you know, so I wrote it as a rhyme poem. And what worked itself out onto the surface of the poem, which I guess was underneath it, was family and society, or family and community, and our friendship, and how what it all comes down to are sort of very simple, sensuous recollection. People shouting at a party, music they play at a party, the house cleaned up for the party, these kinds of things. That it's very ephemeral, isn't it? Friendship. They come and they go.
You know, going back to when we talked the last time, I remember a statement that you made that after a while, writing to you was so important, it was something that you couldn't possibly let go. You know, and then you said family and wife and children or soccer games or whatever, but not writing. What is it that when you go to a party or when you get to a certain point, when you look at something, it propels you, it's a necessity for you to write it, to write whatever it is you're feeling.
It's very easy to be flippant about that. And it's very easy to be serious and profound, and or sound serious and profound. Miller Williams has a marvelous poem about that compulsion, that kind of obsession. That is, I think you're right, that it's what makes some writers very persistent and other people drop out of being writers, because they just aren't persistent in writing down those things that they're compelled to write down. Miller Williams has a poem about standing at his father's grave and thinking, there's a poem in this, you know. And that sounds, you know, almost, you know, pathological, you know, and I suppose it is. And I suppose it is kind of mental illness in the eyes of certain people who would have us all mentally healthy, which I'm not sure is such a brilliant idea, because then you have to have everybody agree to what mental health is. And
well, you describe yourself as obsessive. You describe the forms you choose to write in as obsessive.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And now you're talking about writing poetry, or the urge to write as obsessive.
Yeah, but it doesn't happen instanter like that. You know, it's much more a gestation than, you know, the compulsion. Everything stops and you just sit down and you do it. I mean, that poem to his host who has asked him to stay longer probably took months after the actual idea just began to gestate before I actually started even writing it out.
I guess what I'm getting back to is when you said writing became so important to you.
Mm.
What does it do for you?
Mm.
You said initially it was there may have been the idea of fame. Now that's no longer
an issue. I think it's an interest in what I'm going to find out. The targets change all the time. I wrote, there are a number of poems in recital that are narratives, that are just story poems. And, you know, I mentioned one, Flood, was a narrative that came out of just an image, right? There are other narratives that came out of a word, topiary, which means cutting hedges into interesting shapes, right? And just trying to imagine the kind of mentality involved in that, the kind of person who does it. I invented a gardener working for the younger daughter of a gentleman in England in the year I was born, 1936, right? And I just wrote a poem just to see how it would turn out. Much the same thing as some novelists and short story writers do, you know. It's just to see how it'll turn out. Put a character through a what-if sequence, you know. What if we have the character do this? What if we have, see?
Well, what is the most far-out what-if you've managed to pull off that you could read from?
The most outrageous one is War Criminal. It's an attempt to understand something. It's more an examination of a judicial dilemma. I don't identify for a moment with the character in this, but what I wanted to do was try to use a language that was so ambiguous that at the end of the poem, the reader wondered, was he really the guy they were looking for, or was he a victim, right? Was he himself a victim of mistaken identity, right? But I wanted to use enough detail in there to shadow the doubt, to leave you doubtful whether he was or he wasn't. And what happened in the writing eventually, this sounds a bit arrogant, but what happened in the writing was, by the end of the poem, I wasn't sure myself, you know, whether the guy was actually guilty or not. The other thing in the poem, in this poem, of course, that is the judicial dilemma, is look what happens, the people who are pursuing this man for 30 years or so, they've become consumed by the quest for him to the point that they've lost sight of what is just, And it's not in pursuit of justice, but it's ad hominem, right? It's in pursuit of the man rather than pursuit of justice. War criminal. Nothing I could say would answer you. Legion upon legion of my kind marched into court, tried, hanged, and buried in quicklime would still leave you ravenous. The others from those trials in the newsreels so long ago, with their little sleepless smiles, their shame was yours too, who doled out guilt like fruit or cigarettes. And if you were right, look what trouble I've gone to, removing the past, all the past. And you have taken how long? 30 years and more to find me here. I can give you nothing for your records. This name you give me, I will deny to the end. At the plant, I had a friend who told me his war story, drinking all afternoon, watching football in a bar on Franklin Street. He served in Italy, he said, an easy time, herding old men and boys to prison camps. We laughed together. His story was so good for him, he didn't ask for mine. He too confessed nothing, but he could tell of looting, of a prisoner set on fire, of a shorn woman. You understand, there are so many victims and witnesses. What need is there for me to confess anything? You make me a gift of guilt. No, you are strangers, and I'm too old for hate. Besides, of those years you insist on, that place, I can picture only harvest time, the ripe wheat fields sloping up to green woods, the pale light, the smooth silvery trunk of a beech tree. And you, above all, with your sense of duty, of mission, when you are certain your long hunt is over, what will be your reward? Will you start a new life? Will you wake from nightmares, whispering, innocent? Details, details, I will deny such details. Yes, let these survivors confront me. What will they see? A pensioner with arthritis, who walks his stupid old dog by the river, drinks with the other old men in the bar downtown, small talk and pretzels, beef jerky and football games. 25 years a machinist at the plant. Look, photos of my marriage. She was a nurse, older than me, dead 3 years. Our son, a forester in Colorado, with 2 children. They came for a day to visit me last fall. What could they find in me after 30 years to remind them of such details, these survivors? You see what I'm trying to work at there? It's really a design poem where there's a sort of pattern of language that circles around, is he or is he not the person they're looking for, right? And by having the person speak, he doesn't even know himself, is the idea, whether they're the one he's looking for. All he can remember are wheat fields and silver birch trees, you know. And isn't it Hannah Arendt who's written about the banality of evil? That, you know, when you actually confront people who are involved in that, as the actual perpetrators, to use that marvelous word of the police force, they don't remember any of. They couldn't possibly remain as human beings, you know, and remember, you know. They blot it out, or they dismiss it in some way.
In your, what, the pursuit of a man rather than pursuit of justice, I immediately thought of that other poem you wrote about the picture in the post office.
Identikit.
Identikit.
Yeah. This is the one who did it all. Medium build, neither short nor tall. Eyebrows neither thick nor thin. This is the one who'd do us in. This is the one who got away in a black sedan, a Chevrolet or a Ford. We can't be perfectly sure, but this is the one, we're ready to swear. This is the one with the evil nature, no distinguishing scar or feature, eyes of an indeterminate hue. This is the one, we're telling you. You've got the picture. You can tell from the face he's the mind of a criminal. Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. This is the one, this is the one.
Justice and injustice seems to be something that I don't know whether consciously you are consumed with feelings about it, but I...
You know, I do have a sense of justice. It's probably very wrong-headed and over-idealistic and absolutist, you know. I'm not sure that a sense of justice is the same thing as a sense of right and wrong, because I'm often confused on that, right? When I am the helpless onlooker, and I have a number of poems that take that stand, I suppose. I haven't thought about it in those terms until now, really. But there's a poem, an elegy for a woman washed up on the shores, on the shore, right close to where I was living, actually, in Victoria, B.C. And there's another one about watching soldiers in the Congo kick a villager to death. Just casually kick this villager to death just simply because he was there when they got there. It goes back to 1964, you know. That's certainly the source of a lot of poems of mine, come to think of it. The sense of helplessly standing by and watching injustice being meted out. That's, I think, the contemporary human condition very much, the sense of helplessness. The sense of being a feeling, thinking, imagining entity in a world out of control.
Is there a certain role that a poet has?
Yeah, I think there is. And it goes beyond artistic, and every artist knows this, whether it be poet, or musician, or painter, or sculptor. It's very ancient, and it sounds real arrogant to say it, but it's there. Prophets, you know. Artists in our time are prophets just the same as they were when they were doing up Babylon, you know. Horace, in the time of Caesar Augustus, had the guts to tell Caesar Augustus what was wrong with the way he was running the country. Now, that's prophecy. Shakespeare in his time had the extraordinary moral courage to place plays in front of a London audience, which asked them to take a look at what was happening to their world, a world that the value systems were disintegrating. Shakespeare lived in a time similar to ours. The other role of the artist, I'm expanding it beyond that of the poet, in any time, again, is that of visionary, of seeing for us, of showing us a world that is possible. I'm thinking of Dante, again, in a time of tremendous political and social upheaval in Italy, you know, the collapse of one order and the establishment of a new order, the collapse of the feudal order and the establishment of the mercantile order. And he presented these people with a vision in the Divine Comedy, you know, which transcends all that, you know, mucking around. You know what I mean? So I think, yeah, we have a dual role and always have, that of visionary and prophet.
You must have a tremendous trust of your imagination.
I suppose. Well, saying you trust your imagination is a little bit like saying, this is exaggerated, of course, a bit like saying, I trust the air, you know. It never occurred to me to distrust us. I don't have a choice in that. Where the problem arises is that I will go to my grave not understanding why people like or dislike my work. I will go to my grave not understanding, not really, really accepting. You know, my first reaction when I get a rave review, which I have had the good fortune to have on this latest book, two of, right? My first reaction is, I fooled them. I fooled them again, you know? Which is just childish, right? It's just totally immature. But it comes from a very deep-seated distrust of my own abilities as a poet, you know? And that is a distrust, really, of language to do the job. Well, what Frost says is poetry is what's lost in translation, right? And you're always translating into language a vision, an image, a form. Sometimes it's just a sort of passage of sound, as in passage of music. It's a distrust born out of an absolute necessity to trust the language, you know.
I want to hear another poem where you absolutely
Certainly, let's
language.
Let's read something from The Exile's Book of Hours. The Exile's Book of Hours is a sequence of poems, a day in the life of yours truly, the exile, right? And it's based on Rilke. Rilke has a Book of Hours of a similar sort. Let's read the sonnet from the sequence. It's a sonnet which is a meditation on suicide, but not the exile suicide, but rather the suicide of Frank Stanford and John Berryman and Anne Sexton and Stanley Cooperman, all of whom have, within the last few years, committed suicide, and all of whom were extraordinary fine poets. So the poem is called De Mortuis, from the old Latin tag De Mortuis Nil Nisi Bonum, about the dead we never speak badly. Is it good in broad day to reflect on death, the trick brain's fused circuits, despair's stale breath? Who can grasp the particulars? For example, the young poet who sank from his gun, from a simple surfeit of powers, what generous, tender psalm invited but could not reveal death's mysteries? He wrote of a time on the levee as a boy, becalmed in sunlight. I recall a summer's ebb-tide beach. Shells gleam, strange tokens of a power beyond reach. Neither his death nor the slight catastrophes of my slow going count for more on the globe than, for example, the gnat's fit caught in the trembling web.
This has been the second half of a two-part conversation with poet James J. McCauley. The engineer for this broadcast was Richard Morton. I'm Phyllis Silver. Thank you for listening to Inland Northwest Voices, produced at KPBX, Spokane Public Radio. This program is supported in part by the Washington Commission for the Humanities and the Washington State Arts Commission.
As part of Spokane Public Radio's 40th anniversary Remembrance series, we've just heard Last Night and Tonight, Inland Northwest Voices, featuring poet James McCauley, interviewed so brilliantly by Phyllis Silver in the early 1980s, very few years after this station began as a full-service station in 1980. This interview was from about 1983, and thank you, Phyllis.